I love to go walking in the rain, to climb up a cliff as a bird sings. A quick little look, what's that I see? Some most peculiar, curious things.
Welcome once again to Museum Theatre Musings. I am your host, Jo Klein. If you've just joined us, this is a podcast documenting the theory and practice of museum theatre, a type of applied theatre used in cultural institutions all around the world. Today's guest is Elizabeth Keeney, who is joining us from Washington, D.C. Elizabeth has been a museum educator and a museum theatre practitioner for 20 years. Working from Washington, D.C. to Alaska to California, she has infused her teaching practice with storytelling and theatrical techniques. And in today's episode, we will be discussing the use of participatory theatre in museums and also touching on Elizabeth's most recent role playing Martha Washington at the iconic Mount Vernon. So, Elizabeth, welcome to the podcast. It's so lovely to have you here all the way from Washington, D.C.
Oh, thank you, Jo. It's a thrill to see you again after it's been 14 years.
We're just discussing off before recording when we actually were able to meet in person, and we think we narrowed it down to 2009. When we're recording in 2023 is a very long time ago. But also, you know, talking about how fantastic it is that the emphasis on things like Zoom means that we can pick up conversations we had a long time ago and keep them going. So it's lovely to reconnect, and very much looking forward to what we're going to talk about today, which brings me to my first point. Whenever I have people in the podcast, I like to hear their origin story. So specifically our museum theatre origin story, so how you first found out about museum theatre, when you started in the field, any training or processes you went through and to become a museum theatre practitioner.
Sure, it's so funny. I think lots of people that go into the museum field can pinpoint some experience in their youth that maybe at the time they didn't realize it, but now they think, oh yeah, this is for me. And I would have been, 7 or 8 years old, and the Missouri State History Museum, where former MTEL president Elizabeth Pickard once worked with the Teens Make History program. It's all full circle. But back in the 1980s, when I was a child, they had a day camp and I was signed up. And what we did were different activities in St. Louis, Missouri history, where the museum was. And every day was a different decade. And I distinctly remember the day we did the 20s, we talked about prohibition and gangsters. And at one point, we children were pretending to be in a speakeasy that was getting busted and the feds were coming in and we all had to flee. I don't know how appropriate that program was for eight-year-olds now, but at the time I remember thinking it was thrilling and fun and exciting. And it stayed with me. And then about 10 years later, my mother and I had moved to the DC area where she grew up. And we went down to Williamsburg, and we were at Colonial Williamsburg, which, for those of you that aren't familiar, it's one of the largest outdoor historic museums and sites in the world. It was founded by John D. Rockefeller back in the early part of the 20th century. And they do a lot of museum theater and character interpretation. I was 17 then and not in a very good mood, and I was being a rather sulky teen, and my mom was ready to drag me home by my hair. And she looked at the schedule and she said, well, here, let's go meet Martha Washington. And I was like, oh, whatever. We go in and there was a woman, many of you may be familiar with Mary Wiseman, and she was Martha Washington having conversation with people as they came in and out. 2 hours later, my mom was dragging me out of there and she said, we have to leave. And I didn't know exactly what I had experienced. I didn't realize it was, you know, museum theater as the field. I knew that I had been transformed. And that got me into history. I ended up choosing to go to a college at a site that had the first colonial capital of Maryland. So I got hired there and I was portraying indentured servants, doing very bad English accents. And that's where I realized, oh, museums are a career, and so is museum theater. And I've worked in lots of different kinds of museums. Sometimes my job has had museum theater, sometimes it hasn't. But I find that any kind of, you know, use of storytelling, theatrical technique, all of the things that theater training serves and its more immediate purposes serves anyone that's interacting with a museum audience. So, but yeah, going back and being a child pretending to be at a speakeasy in the 1920s, it's where it all began, I think.
That is such a pivotal moment. And obviously the character of Martha Washington became very significant for you. Now, because we're in Australia, we don't do that level of American history at school, really, except in sort of senior levels. So Martha Washington is not somebody who's such an icon in Australia, but she certainly is in America. And I know that a lot of children will have heard about her, known about stories. And I think there's a lot of school plays where the life of the Washingtons are portrayed. So it's a very familiar character. But I'm particularly interested that you took over this character later in life, quite recently, but also the process of being selected. This is something that's quite unusual in terms of how you take on a character. So can you tell us a little bit more about how you ended up going from a sulky teenager who was transformed and so engaged by this interaction with an actor playing Martha Washington to playing her yourself?
Sure. I mean, you know, serendipity and ending up in the right place at the right time. In 2005, I returned to Mount Vernon. I worked at Mount Vernon very briefly in 2004 before moving to Northern Ireland. And when I returned, I went back to work at Mount Vernon. And this was in the autumn of 2005. And they were preparing for the Candlelight program. Candlelight is a holiday themed program. It's an evening tour where visitors learn about how Christmas was marked or celebrated at Mount Vernon. And part of that is an evening tour in the house. And at that time, you were greeted by Martha Washington in the house. And wouldn't you know, just as I returned from Ireland, Mary Wiseman, the Martha Washington in Colonial Williamsburg, had been hired full time at Mount Vernon. So we both come back, or we're both there at the same time. And I worked with her the very first night of Candlelight in 2005. And that woman spoke nonstop for nearly 5 hours. And afterwards, I literally chased her down and I said, "Will you teach me?" And it began with her saying, "You know, you should start to look at one of Martha Washington's granddaughters," because I was 25 at the time. And so I started on my own doing the research. A lot of my training was actually sitting with Mary as she would interpret the life of Martha Washington in a small space that's called the Interpretive Center at Mount Vernon. And what she does and what she's trained me to do is to really dive so deep into the character that you don't need to rely on a script, and that any question a visitor has, you can answer. And, you know, a lot of it is going and you know, learning, you know, not just their life, but who's in their network? What does their world look like? Where have they been? And it takes years. And it turned out that the granddaughter that I began to research, who had a very interesting life of her own, was even in her lifetime seen as a real legacy bearer of Martha Washington and George Washington too. So a lot of that character was less about her granddaughter, but who were her grandparents? And that was possibly, I think, the perfect training. And all of this, there were sometimes I was doing this at Mount Vernon, sometimes I was doing it freelance. I created the character on my own. So I went into a lot of schools, did a lot of heritage organizations in the US and they're around the world, but there are a lot of organizations like the Daughters of the American Revolution. So they are women who are descended from people who fought in the revolution. They do a lot of things like, you know, keep monuments nice and tidy and fund scholarships for students. And so when they have their meetings and programs, they often like a speaker. And so I was kind of going all around doing this. And I mean, I was living in Alaska, and Mary and I would talk a couple times a month, and we would talk about theory and practice and how do you do this and how do you draw people in. So it was, you know, from 05 on, it was like the old guilds where you have the master craftsman and the apprentice. And so that's how we really thought of it. I was trying to find it. I know I have it somewhere. I've just moved so many times. We actually wrote up a contract when we realized that one day I could, you know, portray Mrs. Washington having been selected by Mary. And this was sort of outside of Mount Vernon. Mary is an institution unto herself. She created the term character interpretation while she was working in Williamsburg. And really, and there are lots of ways to do character interpretation. And I find that her version is so effective. When you would see her, one of the most common comments she would get, and I would get, to be candid, is it really felt like I was talking with her. And so it was just this relationship that Mary and I forged. And when there was some staff changing in 2016, Mount Vernon supported me coming back. So for the first year, I portrayed one of her granddaughters again. And then we actually had, it was one of the most incredible experiences I've had as a museum professional and a museum theater practitioner. We restaged the arrival of the Washingtons to Mount Vernon. Because one of the things, as you said, Mrs. Washington is iconic, but people don't really know her. They can pick her photo out. They know she was George Washington's wife, but they don't know that those two, they married when they were 27. She wasn't always the old lady they're used to seeing. So they got a carriage. We had a young George Washington and children portraying her, two children that she brought to the marriage. And we literally came up and physically entered Mount Vernon, brought the Washingtons home. And that was sort of the debut. And Mary and I then split the schedule. So for, you know, the next few years from 2018 until 2020, 7 days a week, you could meet Mrs. Washington. Now, sometimes you got young Martha, as we called her, and the other times Lady Washington that Mary had created over, you know, 30 years at Williamsburg. So it was a strange sort of, we had had this plan and vision in place. And then in 2016, Mount Vernon, you know, supported, you know, starting to put that into practice.
And succession planning. So she was able to choose her successor and hand over something very important. I don't know if you mentioned, but how long did she play Martha Washington all to get for how many years throughout her career did she play her?
Yeah, it was in the late 80s, early 90s that she first started researching Mrs. Washington and was really blown away because, again, I think many in the U.S. be like, oh yeah, I know Martha Washington, the old lady in the big cap. And to be able to portray her, because when I started, I was portraying her before the revolution happened. So they're proud and loyal subjects of His Majesty King George. And that's not a Mrs. Washington people think about a lot. So that was a great opportunity. What Mary does and what she trained me to do was to truly make it participatory. Now, there's, again, I'm a big tent kind of person. I think there's room for all kinds of museum theater. But I will say, when you can let the visitor drive the conversation and ask the questions they want to ask, and that's where we kind of go down. Now, I will say, you know, when someone would ask, you know, one question, I would know sort of how I was going to answer it, because a lot of the questions would be a lot of the same. And then it's like, okay, good. And where can I take this that might bring us to a new insight? But it wasn't, here I am, listen to me tell you about Martha Washington.
It's not a monologue. Sometimes people can turn something into a soliloquy or a monologue, and there's no room for discussion. But it does bring me to an interesting question, which is, when people are talking now about types of interpretation, they look at whether there is any flexibility to break character and what the policies are at a particular institution, because there's so much to admire about being fully immersed in the character and not acknowledging modern times. But if a character, an audience member should ask you about something that happened afterwards, whether you go, oh, I don't know anything about that, or they say, you know, oh, there's no internet signal in here, you go, what's that? So how you handle those kind of questions.
Sure. And Mount Vernon had a policy mostly to protect staff from hostile or inappropriate visitors, that if someone, because we, there are people that portray enslaved people there, and you know, there are people in this world that will be completely inappropriate and abusive even to our to the staff. So, you know, the rule was you can always shut it down. I think women can get a lot of potential abuse as well. And so I was, for the most part, fortunate. I was confident in my ability to control my space. And again, for the most part, I was in the interpretive center. So it's a small room. It used to be the museum at Mount Vernon, and it's got a little raised dais and some chairs. So it's set up like a parlor. For things like, for me, it was always a student shoving a cell phone in your face and saying, do you know what this is?
So baiting is something that people tend to engage in, particularly, I suppose, school students might find it amusing to heckle and bait the performers. But the other thing is, it depends what the environment is, whether the people enter it are very clear about the rules of engagement. So they take their cues from you as a performer, they take their cues from the space and any kind of briefing or signage that might be around. And generally also I find that other audiences will sometimes try and shut down the heckler or the baiter because Absolutely. They're just like, no, I want to hear this, stop it.
Absolutely. Well, and I also think that at the end of the day, we are trying to support the guest learning, that they're having a meaningful experience. And so, you know, I think, unfortunately, there have been times when visitors, you know, will, you know, ask for something or can I take a picture? And it's like, oh, what is that device? And it's like, just say yes and take your picture.
Okay. Yes, you can take my portrait and go, that's a lovely likeness.
You know, it doesn't, if it's, you know, I think it's this idea of wanting to be so accurate, but then are you not making it an inclusive and belonging space for the visitor? Are you inviting them into your world, or are you saying, if you say one wrong thing, you're going to be shamed? Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, unfortunately, something that can happen. And we have to be very, very careful. Again, my approach was always, I'm here to support their learning. Now, before COVID, I was in 1769 and nothing beyond that. Now, I had a space where a volunteer would remind them outside. This is before the presidency. This is before the war. People would forget. They would get excited. And I think there are ways that you can answer the question without shutting them down. I think sometimes visitors get embarrassed. And then if we make them feel foolish for asking a question with us, they're going to not want to ask a question in other situations.
Absolutely. It's about the learning. And also, you know, you do want people to take photos because you want what you do shared. You want more people to come in. But I think it's also lovely that you have a volunteer who can help frame the experience first. And I suppose if the worst came to the worst, the audience member could ask the volunteer because they're not in character. So mm-hmm. You can always, you know, if there were questions, they could make the decision, do I ask Martha Washington this? Mm-hmm. Or is this something I could ask the volunteer just outside the door? Who would be better at answering this question?
Yeah. And I mean, and again, with the thing with technology, especially young people, I would turn it back on them and say, I'm not familiar with that. Tell me what it does. And then they'd say, oh, well, it's to communicate to that. And then that can bring in, you know, when I was, because many don't realize Martha Washington was with George Washington every winter during the War of Independence. So it was corresponding with people all over. So instead of being like, oh, I have no idea, turn it around so that it's, because the other thing is when people ask those kinds of questions, are you hot in that? Do you know what a phone is? They want to participate and they don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
So we can choose to maybe be a little less perfectly historically accurate for 2 seconds, or, you know, and invite them in, or you can make a whole thing about it and then they don't want to ask a question or engage with someone again. So
I suppose I don't know much about Martha Washington's personality. Was she a friendly, welcoming sort of person? Because it must be very hard to kind of portray someone and be welcoming to visitors if the person you're portraying is a bit prickly and was known to not like people.
You know, the research historian who worked at Mount Vernon for over 40 years compiled, it's 70 pages, and it's everything anyone ever wrote down about Martha Washington during her lifetime, and then things that were written and published in newspapers after she died. Almost every single one of them is absolutely glowing how she made people feel comfortable and at home. But we have to remember, these are all people that were almost all white, almost all wealthy, not necessarily of her class, but that saw her as a national figure. We don't know what the people that she enslaved felt. We don't have what they wrote about her or thought about her. She was an unapologetic enslaver, unlike George Washington. She did not change her mind about slavery. And that can be difficult because, you know, she was warm and loving with some people. You know, she owned people. She, you know, controlled what they did. She had the power to mete out violence towards them if she felt that was necessary or appropriate. One of stories that we talk, that Mount Vernon talks a lot about, is a young woman named Ona Judge, who was a enslaved maidservant to Martha Washington. When her daughter, one of her granddaughters, was getting married, Ona learned she was going to be given as a wedding gift, and she ran away. She took her freedom, literally walked out of the president's house in Philadelphia, and Martha Washington spent the rest of her life, which is about 8 more years, sending people to get Ona back.
Wow.
So,
which I'm pretty sure, an interesting point. When people come and meet you as Martha Washington, do they ever see you interacting with other characters? Because that's a very telling thing. So there's interacting with an audience, but do they see how Martha interacts with people of different social classes or?
Very little. They're doing more of that. Mount Vernon is, in the past year and a half, has started to do both more scripted things and more ensemble pieces. Before, the characters would sort of be stationed in different places. My former colleague, Brenda Parker, who portrayed Caroline Branham for many years at Mount Vernon, though she has also left the institution, she and I tried a program in which they would meet Doll, who was the cook at one of the many enslaved cooks at Mount Vernon. And Doll would be out next to the kitchen, would engage visitors. And this was advertised, it was scheduled and advertised. And then Mrs. Washington would come, interact with Doll and the audience, and then walk away. So that the audience had the opportunity to see Doll without her enslaver nearby, but then see how they would interact together. And then Mrs. Washington would remove, and if there were more follow-up questions. It was a program that only happened twice. And then we had, you know, COVID come and things changed. And so, and that's the kind of program that I think is really important, because again, it all depends on who she was interacting with. Was she a kind person? You know, it's not kind to own people.
No, it's nice that that level of nuance is built in, because we need those different historical perceptions to come out in performance so that people don't think that the characters are one-dimensional.
Sure. And right now, Mount Vernon has a play. They don't take questions as characters, but it's focusing on the experience of a man named Christopher Shields, who was Washington's enslaved valet. And Christopher interacts with one of Washington's friends, as well as his private secretary. And those characters come in and out of the scene so they can see Christopher on his own versus Christopher with people that were very close to the Washingtons as friends and paid staff members. So they're still, you know, making sure to incorporate that.
Roll up, roll up. There's plenty to see.
Really wanted to discuss in today's episode is participatory theatre. Something you mentioned before is a technique that a lot of people use in museum theatre, but for somebody who's never heard of it, can you tell us what is participatory theatre?
I would say it's a spectrum of opportunities. So it might be a performance where different sections of the audience are given different cheers to sound, or someone is brought up out of the audience to participate, like a volunteer in a magic show.
As long as they don't run away first. Not everyone is massively, I don't know, volunteers in magic shows sometimes have a little bit of a bad rap because they think you're going to somehow humiliate them. And some magicians do, to be fair, they've probably seen it before. I like to reassure all my volunteers. I just a little side, we're in the right in the middle of the Melbourne Magic Festival here in Melbourne, Australia. So there'll be a lot of people volunteering for a lot of shows over these 2 weeks of the school holidays. But yes, that is an example of participatory theatre.
And then, Joe, you and I had chatted a little bit about this, you know, some of the kind where the participants really drive everything. You know, there are so many incredible children's theater programs and museum theater programs where the participants, the guests, they do the research, they write the scripts, they perform all the different parts. And that might be not just playing a character or performing a role, but being a props master or being a stage manager. Elizabeth Pickard's Teens Make History program that she ran for ages at the Missouri History Museum there in St. Louis.
I've spent a bit of time looking into that, and it's a very exciting thing. I hope Elizabeth will be a guest on this podcast because
she's
I'm
wonderful.
Certainly hoping to hear more about that because it just sounds fascinating.
Yeah, and so it's, you know, inviting the audience member to have some part or role, and that can be all kinds. It can be, you know, say this line that we give you on a piece of paper in this larger experience. Or it is, you know, what I really loved when I was portraying Martha Washington at Mount Vernon. What do you want to know about? Like, I would give an intro and then it's open for your discussion. What are you curious about? And so it has, so I guess that's again, but as I said, it's a spectrum. It can be, you know, very simple and straightforward, almost sort of a guided here, do this thing, to what do you want your experience to be in this theatrical program play experience? So there's lots of things in there.
Obviously, there's lots of different techniques people use, but with participatory theatre, why do you think it's particularly helpful at cultural institutions or heritage sites? It's something that's used a lot in children's theatre, so maybe in more traditional theatre or puppetry or theatre in education. But specifically, can you think of any examples where a participatory moment has really led to a much richer interpretation or experience at a site?
Sure. I think at its best, what participatory theater encourages, not just in the performer, but in the participant, the guest, the audience, is there's active listening and being open to new ideas. And that, and especially again, when I was portraying someone like Martha Washington, who held ideas that most people today would find, you know, abhorrent and repellent, you know, there's opportunities for them to disagree with her. Other times they could agree with another character. And these are the kinds of things that I think build any kind of democratic society. When we actively listen to one another, when we are approaching something open to new ideas, and that collaboration, when we're building things together. It was always, I had lovely feedback from guests at Mount Vernon. And I always, sort of wished I would come out of character, because I wouldn't do that very often. Part of me thinks, well, if you're just going to come out of character, why be in character in the first place? But well, that's a whole other podcast. It's another episode. But, it's like, no, we created this together. It's a very constructivist approach to learning. And so I think those are the things, because the other thing is when visitors have those experiences, when that becomes, oh, I feel comfortable sharing my thoughts. I feel comfortable participating, adding to this experience, they're going to take that comfort and the confidence they get from it and use it in other ways. So again, that's why I always like to say that, these kinds of things do have the ability and the potential to change and improve the world if we're creating people that become more active listeners, if they come, if they work in collaboration with each other.
Did you notice a big difference in the way people of different age groups participated or with you or interacted with you? So perhaps a school student versus maybe a middle-aged overseas visitor versus an elderly person who's interested in history and heritage coming to the site. How did they respond differently to your character?
So, what I found was less to do with age and more to do with how much museum theater experience did they seem to have had. Often children are very open. And I mean, if you think about it, children play pretend all the time. In fact, I once did a career day at the local elementary school when I was living in DC, and I don't think they knew what to do with me. So they gave me to the fourth grade pre-K. And I said, do you guys like to pretend? And so we did, so we played some pretending games, and I was like, that's what I do. So I think children are often, especially the early learners, open because they play pretend, they will go there. I think as you get older, it has to do with how much exposure they had to this kind of experience and what kind of experience was it? Did a character at or a performer in a museum like this, were they made to feel embarrassed or silly? They're less interested. And what I think is a good challenge for those of us that do this really participatory, that's asking the visitor to be vulnerable with us, it's a great opportunity to help build trust with those that are like, I'm not into it. But again, just having been a museum educator for 20 years, just because someone's not, asking a question or offering something in the conversation, maybe they're sitting in the back and they're very quiet, that doesn't mean they're not having a rich and meaningful experience. I think, so it was less for me what their ages were, but like, did they feel comfortable in that space? And if they weren't feeling comfortable, what was my challenge to make sure that they understood this was a space of belonging, that you're not going to be made fun of? Because I would ask questions to spark conversation, and they would often be pretty low stakes. So we had a reproduction of Martha Washington's gown, and it was gold. And I said, what color shoes do you think I wore with this? And it didn't matter what the right answer was. I had them in my basket. I was going to pull them out and show them. And that was a way. And if they got an answer that wasn't the color of the shoes, I would answer it in a way that wasn't, no, you're wrong. It was, oh, that would have been a very fashionable choice. So, so it's this opportunity again to build trust so that people feel comfortable engaging with that.
Which is interesting, because this is exactly how you handle student questioning or student suggestions in a classroom environment. So you never just go, no, that's wrong. You'd respond with something like, I like the way you're thinking about that, or I can see which steps you've taken to get to that point, or how can you think more along those lines? So my question would be, a lot of museum theatre practitioners are also educators. Some are purely actors. You've obviously got that background in both education and acting. How do you think the education mindset has shaped what you do in terms of performance as a practitioner?
Oh, I think it really opened my eyes. I had worked at two museums where I had portrayed historic characters, one at a place called Roanoke Island Festival Park in North Carolina, and then at historic St. Mary's City. And I was young and I was learning, but I think my focus shifted from how can I share this with the guests to what do I need to do to support guest experience and learning? And sometimes, you know, I do use the word learn a lot because I went back to get my, I have my master's degree in museum education. So I'm definitely, you know, where's the opportunity to learn? But it isn't open head pouring knowledge. Again, it's that constructivist idea. So like you were saying, you know, don't just shut down if someone gives an answer that's not quite the one you were looking for. Make it, no, this is, you know, a place where you can throw an idea out and see if that's where we're headed. And maybe that'll take us down another path. And really at the end of the day, I mean, and I used to say this a lot when I was working at Mount Vernon, I was like, I don't care if they know when Martha Washington was born or if she did this or that. Are they comfortable going and seeking more information out? Did I spark questions? Because again, it's that lifelong learning and engaging that is really the crux of it. Yes, are there certain historic facts I hope they would remember about her? Absolutely. But if they don't, that's fine. You know, did they feel that they were engaged, that they were included and belonged? And I do think participatory theater, museum theater or theater really has the all the elements to create that when it's done well, when it's done with, you know, the visitor meaning making learning in mind. Sorry, I'm very long-winded.
No, that was fantastic. It's really nice to reflect on what the multiple objectives are in museum theatre. There is the engagement element, there's the enduring understanding, and there's also that ability to, I think, also feel comfortable in a museum environment. I mean, it's something you want students and all kinds of visitors to come back and feel comfortable, which is interesting because what I've heard from other performers who play a character and are known for that character is that often they have repeat visitors who come back to visit them. Do you have any stories or anecdotes to share about people who come back to see you as Martha Washington?
Yes, I have so many. And it was one of the things that was a little bittersweet to step away from when I left, but, you know, especially a lot of young people. There was a woman and her daughter, and they would come all the time. And the daughter was really shy at first. And then we became very good friends. They would come, I would host a tea a couple times a year. This was something Mary had started and I continued. And girl's mother really said, you know, she has come out of her shell, not just with you, but with lots of people. They were so sweet. They moved. They're a military family, but we keep in touch. I would still, the daughter made me one of those hook crochet. It was like she called it a cushion for Mrs. Washington's teapot.
Oh my goodness.
And so I would put it under the teapot for every tea and take a picture and posted on Instagram and tag her mother in it. And we still chat. And, you know, I had a family that's local that comes all the time. And again, you know, this is where it's like, I was 7 and fully immersed in an experience. And, you know, I was 17 and was transfixed by this woman that created a world that I could enter and feel safe and interested in and could ask questions and could, you know, so I think that is so, so important. And knowing too that, you know, we have those wonderful friends that come back time and again, but I would have people, and one of the greatest compliments I would get when I portrayed Mrs. Washington, people thought I was Mary sometimes. There's something of an age difference. But when people would say, no, 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 we had tea 25 years ago in Williamsburg, I was like, okay, well, I would just be very gracious and say, oh, it's a pleasure to see you again. I would have people, and other times people thought I was Mary's like actual biological daughter because our portrayals, and I wasn't mimicking her, but you know, to continue the character she had done. And it is an important legacy, you know, that Mary is an icon in her own right doing that work. And it's thrilling. And again, when people feel, oh, this is a place I belong, this is a place I'm at home. Do they know when, I don't know, the Newburgh conspiracy happens? Doesn't matter. No, they can Google that. That's on Wikipedia. They can go on the museum's website and find that information. Do they feel that that institution is a place where they can come and feel belonging and welcomed?
That's fantastic. Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing the journey that you went on to take this character. I just think you've really, really mined the depths of it here. And I'm really fascinated by this idea of apprenticeship in museum theatre. So it's something I certainly will look for other examples of. But yet again, thank you so much for being on the podcast, sharing your stories. And even though no one can see this, we're actually wearing the same top. So without coordinating before, we are dressed pretty much identically, which is,
it was amazing.
It's an interesting thing that we've synchronized our clothing somehow across basically the entire world and time zones. But thank you again. And we look forward to hearing about your future projects as well. Bye.
Absolutely. Thank you. Take care. Bye.
The theme music for this episode is the title song from These Curious Things, a piece of museum theatre written by Michael Mills of Heaps Good Productions in Adelaide, Australia, and performed by Gemma Dandy and Michael Mills.